Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we look at education in the Valley. What does it mean for local schools now that voters have approved Proposition 58, reversing the ban on bilingual education in the classroom? We'll talk to Mackenzie Mays of the Fresno Bee. Plus, the fallout from last week's decision by the Kern High School District to allow teachers to carry guns in the classroom. Harold Pierce from the Bakersfield Californian will join us. We begin our program today, though, with another in our series of reports on Valley Fever, which we're calling Just One Breath. It's a collaborative project featuring this station, the Bakersfield Californian, and a number of other outlets about the fungal disease that affects so many here in Central California. On our last program, we told you about how Valley Fever numbers are spiking this year and how many people believe it's due to the weather. This week, we talk about a potential route to prevention of the disease. One of the first lines of defense against any illness is determining who's at risk. It's possible to develop immunity to Valley Fever, and a new skin test could be used to screen for that immunity. But as FM 89's Carrie Klein reports, that's only if the test overcomes some major hurdles.
Faith Herod wants to be a veterinarian when she grows up. She's 11 and lives in the moor with her family and six pets.
We have a collie, which is named Moses, a chihuahua, which is named Jasmine, a black and white cat, which is named Fandy.
In her free time, Faith should be out playing with her dogs. But for almost a year, she wasn't able to. She would come home from school at 4 p.m. and go right to bed. That's because last October, the sixth grader was diagnosed with Valley Fever, a fungal infection that kept her out of school for months and left her with chronic headaches and pain.
Sometimes when you get super tired, it'll feel like your ribs go in and hurt really bad.
Faith contracted Valley Fever by breathing in fungal spores carried by the wind. That's how the disease is contracted, and it can happen at any time. Faith's mother, Karen Herod, isn't entirely sure when it happened, but her best guess is while they were doing yard work one day, something they had done dozens of times before. Herod never would have thought that after so much time, Faith could still be at risk.
If I had known that she was susceptible, it would have been different. We would have done things differently.
As it turns out, Faith and her mother could have known. A new skin test called Sphereosol can detect whether a person is immune, meaning they've overcome Valley Fever before. Because most Valley Fever cases are asymptomatic, many people who have battled the disease never know it. Advocates are excited about the test. So are doctors, like John Galgiani, director of the University of Arizona's Valley Fever Center for Excellence.
I think that Sphereosol's best use will be in primary care doctors' offices to test their patients on a routine basis to find out if they've indeed previously had Valley Fever.
If patients knew they had never conquered the disease, they could better prepare themselves against it. And doctors might be more likely to diagnose it if patients show unusual symptoms. So Galgiani's buying Sphereosol by the bucketful, right? Not exactly.
Frankly, I don't use it very often myself. And even specialists don't use it very often.
That's because the Food and Drug Administration hasn't actually approved the test for use as a Valley Fever screening tool. Right now, it's indicated for use after the disease has already been diagnosed.
If the labeling is changed to allow the test to be used to test for prior infection, then it opens up a whole different value of the test to the clinical community.
Valley Fever lurks in dirt and dust throughout the desert Southwest. Most people who inhale the spores fight off the disease without ever knowing they had it. Some develop flu or pneumonia-like symptoms. In rare cases, it can cause severe lung infection or disseminate through the body, requiring lifelong treatment or leading to fatal meningitis. But there is some good news.
Once you've had Valley Fever and gotten over it, you are, for all practical purposes, immune from a second infection.
That's why Sphereosol could have such an impact. It could reveal that past history most of us can only wonder about. The way it works is similar to a tuberculosis skin test. A doctor injects a small amount of the spores under the skin, and the reaction indicates whether immunity has developed. Tests like this were first developed in the 1930s, but were discontinued in the 90s. Spheriosol was released in 2014 and costs about $62. No studies have directly compared it to previous tests. Right now, Spheriosol is only indicated for use after a patient has been diagnosed with the disease. So instead of being a way to screen for valley fever exposure, it's considered a sort of immune system checkup.
It's indicated for understanding how their body is reacting to the disease. Is their immune system engaged, or is their immune system overwhelmed, or are they potentially immunocompromised and not able to respond to the infection?
Tom Carpenter is president and CEO of Nielsen Biosciences, the San Diego-based company that manufactures Spheriosol. He says, yeah, screening patients is a great way to use the test, but getting the FDA to approve could take years. It would involve new clinical trials and potentially millions of dollars of investment. He says they're looking into it. In the meantime, he points out, doctors are allowed to do whatever they want with Spheriosol off-label.
Healthcare providers right now have the ability to make a medical judgment on how best to use the skin test. So it's certainly not preventing them from making that use, but we can't speak to that use.
But using Spheriosol off-label has challenges too, like the fact that the test is packaged in bulk. Here's Royce Johnson, chief of infectious disease at Kern Medical in Bakersfield.
Even though the product is extraordinarily stable, at least many pharmacies, once you open a vial, they won't let you keep it more than 30 days. So if you don't use it all, it costs a lot of money. So there's some resistance to stocking it.
Another problem, Spheriosol is only approved for 18 to 64-year-olds, even though children can be hit hard, and the CDC says people over 60 are most at risk. Spheriosol didn't work out for Karen and Faith Herod. But despite all its challenges, the test has been used preventively in one very large patient group, California prisons. We'll explore that in a later story. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
And stay tuned later on in our program. We'll hear the first-person story of a individual in Central California who's dealing with valley fever. That's coming up later in our show. This is Valley Edition. Last week, the Kern High School District Board voted to approve a plan to allow teachers and community members with concealed weapons permits to carry their guns on campus. The move was controversial both because of the topic itself and also the last-minute nature of the meeting and vote. Joining us now is Bakersfield, Californian education reporter Harold Pierce, who has been following the story. Harold, welcome.
Hi, Joe. Thanks for having me.
First of all, didn't the board already vote on this about 6 months ago? It seems like this popped up again. Why was this vote significant if they had already voted on it before?
It keeps getting dragged on. And, you know, what they voted on 6 months ago was a CCW permit application for non-employees. And they thought they ought to have different standards for folks who are teachers and certificated staff members. So that's what they did this past week. And it was a very unusual meeting from a few different standpoints. First of all, it was a special session, and those are often referred to as these emergency meetings. They're usually for litigation practices or for real estate matters, not typically to hold a vote for something they've been discussing for the better part of a year. What's also unusual about it is the policy they were voting on was a first and final reading, which is not very common at all. Generally, when policies are passed, they have first readings and second readings before they go to a final vote. In this case, it really felt like it was rushed through, and they went ahead and they passed that policy 3-2 on last Thursday.
So what was the rush all of a sudden? Because they had been talking about the implementation of this policy for some time. I even heard in your reporting and others that they had some people had said on the board, well, this might take a year to implement. All of a sudden, this comes out last Wednesday that in 24 hours, the board was going to have this meeting and all of a sudden pass this proposal.
Right, Joe. They've been talking about this for 10 months, and they've been doing research for it. And, I mean, it's even included a trip out to Texas. Brenda Lewis, the assistant superintendent of instructional services, has been taken away and tasked with researching CCW permits. She's gone to Texas. It cost the district roughly $1,600 for that trip, so she can observe a firearms training course over there. And then None of the research was actually even implemented into the policy that was passed on Thursday. There's no administrative regulations that were passed. And the reason they rushed this through, and this is by the own admission of the board president, Mike Williams, he had said that he didn't want a new board member coming on and making that decision for the board. And why that's important is because Chad Vegas, who's been a proponent of this for a very long time, he's leaving the board. He decided earlier this year he couldn't serve anymore. He wasn't going to run for a fourth term because anti-discrimination anti-discrimination laws, he didn't want to enforce them. He said it would violate his religious conscience to have to enforce those laws. So they saw him going out, and they saw somebody else coming in and the potential for that person to vote against it potentially. And it also has to deal with the amount of knowledge that person has on the issue, is what Mike Williams has been saying, is that he didn't want somebody who hasn't been involved in the discussions about the CCW permits coming in and voting on it when he's not educated on it.
So where does this stand right now, given the actions of the board earlier this year and then last Thursday? What's the status of this in real life?
Well, in real life, at this point, what Mike Williams, the president of the board, has said is that nobody's going to go out and, you know, get this immediately. Teachers aren't going to be granted this. It's all at the superintendent's discretion. So the superintendent's not going to be able to he could technically, in terms of the policy, approve a teacher to come in and do it right now. But what the actual policy did was allow the superintendent and give some direction to the superintendent to start creating some administrative regulations to put this thing into practice. They say it should be in practice within a year, to allow teachers who are CCW permit holders to come onto campus with their firearms. And they've talked about, you know, different training for these folks and different regulations for these folks, none of which has been put into practice yet. They've talked about having 40 to 80 hours of firearms training. They talked about limiting the caliber size, having frangible bullets so they wouldn't be able to penetrate walls, things like that. But obviously none of that's been written yet.
Now, there is one group of people, and that's non-staff members. I understand some of them are already in the process of going into this concealed weapons on campus process.
It's not even a process. They've already been approved. There's been about 13 folks who have been approved for this, and I believe three or four of them are actually members of Chad Vegas. Chad Vegas is a current high school district trustee who's going to be gone here in the next couple of weeks. He actually holds church services at Frontier High School for Sovereign Grace Church, and three or four of his members have actually signed up for this permit process. And Chad Vegas himself has said during public meetings that he's a CCW permit holder. All the while, these last 10 months, he's really been a proponent of this policy because he says that he doesn't want church members who use the facilities on the weekends to be disbarred from carrying their CCWs and carrying their firearms onto campuses. So it's actually interesting. Chad had posted something on Facebook. He was upset about the fact that we had written about this and called out some of his church members for it. We didn't name any names. However, he was upset because he feels like they're being made targets out of, which I find confusing, Joe, since he's asked for the entire current high school district to have CCW permits, and the position of the board has been that makes the school safer.
Is there any thought that with a new board that is seated in the coming weeks that maybe this issue could come back up, given that it was a 3-2 vote and given that his seat apparently was the critical vote in passing this this measure?
There's potential for it, but, we've pressed Joby O'Connell, the individual who is taking Chad Vegas' seat in a couple of weeks here on this matter. We've asked him his position, and he really had no say on it. He said he wasn't educated enough in the policy to opine on it one way or the other. I think it's always a possibility it could come up again, and they could discuss it, you know, in a few months. I mean, the whole time there were folks who were asking for a sunset policy on this, a sunset clause where the board can come back and discuss it and see how it went after a year. But as of right now, there's no thing like that in the policy that was enacted on Thursday.
And we know how many community members are already in this permit approval. Do we know how many potential teachers, school employees might be interested in something like this? Have any of them spoken out on the record saying, I want to do this?
Nobody's spoken out on the record that we know of so far, and we don't know the number of teachers who actually have CCW permits. From all indications, it would be a very low number, which, you know, Chad Vegas has said, I don't understand why people are assigning so much importance to this matter, and he doesn't understand why there's been such a large amount of media attention toward it, because he thinks that he'd be lucky if we get one teacher at each campus. He thinks it'd be miraculous, which calls into question why the board has spent 10 months, better part of 10 months, and a lot of just resources talking about this matter and researching the matter.
Harold Pierce with the Bakersfield Californian with us today on Valley Edition. The Kern High School District also in the news for another issue, and that is Tulare County prosecutors who were investigating alleged misuse of the law enforcement database that the state uses called CLEATS by district employees have said no wrongdoing, no charges will be filed. What's the latest on that? And I guess it cleared one alleged potential whistleblower, but what exactly happened there?
Yeah, oh boy, this is a long, complicated story there, Joe, and I'll try to whittle it down as much as possible. So earlier this year, obviously, the Kern High School District was accused. Some high-level administrators were accused of misusing the sensitive police database. And for those who are unfamiliar, Kern High School District has their own police department on campus. They're not a security force. They have the same rights and privileges, same background check systems as any other Kern County Sheriff's Department or the BPD. And so it came out this past year that for years, some administrators were misusing that system. What it came down to recently was the current sheriff's department had recommended charges against those folks. DA declined to press charges because there was a statute of limitations that had lapsed and there was a lack of evidence. After that had occurred, Joseph Lopetegui, the former he's the current police chief, is on administrative leave right now. He is the whistleblower who called the district out on this. Well, the district came back sometime later, and Mike Zulfa, the HR director over there, had said, actually, Lopetegui was the one who was misusing that system. He ran a CLEATS check against a son-in-law who was actually, or is a stepson, who actually was a current high school district employee and who was an heroin addict, and he had unfortunately passed away sometime later. But Lopetegui had good reason to use that background check system on this individual. He was under the impression that he was using again and that that potentially he had some arrest warrants open. So he checked his name, and that's what is at the center of this this most recent news. They couldn't send it to the sheriff's department because Lopetegui used to work there, so there was a conflict of interest. They couldn't send it to the DA's office because Brenda Lewis, who we talked about earlier having a Texas trip, she's the superintendent over instruction, her daughter works for the DA's office. So they sent it to Tulare County District Attorney's office, and they came back and they said very strongly that there was absolutely no criminal wrongdoing here with Joseph Lopetegui related to this CLEATS scandal.
But what about the allegations that Lopetegui essentially unveiled when he was the whistleblower talking about prior use by the district of the CLEATS database to investigate others in the past? Is that still open, or is it just because the statute of limitations has passed there, it's a moot point?
You know, it's tough to say right now. We know for sure that the current sheriff's department has finished up their investigation, recommended charges. The DA has declined to press charges. So that's where it's at locally. We're still not sure if there's a DOJ investigation. They would not comment on that matter months ago. They still won't. And then as far as Lopetegui is concerned, I mean, the Tulare County DA didn't investigate that matter at all. They didn't look at all into the previous allegations. But Lopetegui does have a civil suit filed, or a government claim, which is a precursor to a civil suit filed for about $2.2 million against the district. He filed that in August, and he's claiming whistleblower retaliation. So if that goes to trial, I think we're going to see a lot more come out of this. And it would be really interesting to see those 247 names that were run under the CLEATS system last year. I think that if that goes to trial and those names come out, there's a very strong possibility that a lot of those names are going to end up being civil suits individually or possibly a class action.
It'll be very interesting, and we'll follow it in the Bakersfield, Californian, with Harold Pierce, who joins us today on Valley Edition. Harold, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me, Joe.
And
take care.
And stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment on Valley Edition. In the next half of our program, we'll talk with David Moss Masumoto and his daughter Nikiko Masumoto about their new books, one about the generations of farming and also Yosemite. That's coming up, plus Mackenzie Mays of the Fresno Bee, more education talk in just a moment on Valley Edition. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. Earlier this month, California voters approved a big change to education in the state when they passed Proposition 58. The initiative overturned a prior voter-approved ban on bilingual education in California. Now the challenge local districts face is implementing the new law. Joining us now is Mackenzie Mays of the Fresno Bee, who's written about this in the paper. Mackenzie, welcome back.
Thank you.
So 58 is law now, Proposition 58, overturning that past ban on dual-track immersion programs. Tell us what this actually means in real life. Is it already implemented? Is it already law, or is there a waiting period?
Yeah, so bilingual classes already exist, you know, but what this means now is that schools are able to do some more outreach about it. Before, parents had to say, you know, learn about it on their own and then sign a waiver and get that waiver through this process. And there was a lot of documentation and regulation. And now schools, especially in Fresno Unified, feel like sort of a weight has been lifted and these barriers have been broken down and they're ready to go.
So I understand there's a lot of research on this. What does that say, and how is it informing the way the districts are going about expanding these services now?
I just sat in on some bilingual classes, and any teacher who teaches bilingual courses basically says that bilingual kids are just better at everything. They grow up to be really intelligent. They think of more solutions to problems because they're living in two different worlds, essentially, and their brains just sort of become wired in a way that monolingual people are not.
So what is Fresno Unified, for example, doing on this front right now to change up to meet the new law?
Well, Fresno Unified was actually sort of ahead of the curve. They had invested millions earlier this year because we have a big number of Spanish-speaking children, but also Hmong-speaking children. So we're trying to beef it up there and just sort of preaching the gospel that is dual immersion classes, which are really interesting. You sort of just throw a kid in. And a lot of people think that these kids that want to be in these classes, or the parents that want them in there, come from Spanish-speaking homes. And the class I just visited, that's not true. None of the parents spoke anything but English. They just see the value in it and sign their kids up. So I think the school districts around here are just excited to be able to not sort of be held back anymore.
What is the scale of this for a district like Fresno Unified that has a lot of immigrants, a lot of individuals who are potentially bilingual? I understand it's around 16,000 students.
Yeah, about a quarter of students in Fresno Unified are English learners. And Fresno Unified is one of the largest districts in California, so it's a huge chunk of people that are affected. But even that, you know, you can have non-English learners who want to sign up to hopefully become bilingual, because when you start at that young age, they're putting kids in Spanish-only classrooms at 3 and 4 years old. So it just naturally happens for them. If I were to try to learn Spanish now, it would be much harder for me as an adult than for them. And, you know, they ask to go to the bathroom and the teacher will never reply in English and say yes or what do you need. She replies in Spanish and sort of reaffirms that. And they don't scold you for speaking English because they want you to speak that too. But you just learn that, you know, here, this is what we say. And so it's really easy for them to grasp at least what Spanish speakers are saying, and then eventually learn how to speak on their own.
With the potential increase in demand for these types of courses, are districts looking at shifting resources, hiring more employees? I know you look specifically at Fresno Unified here. Do you know anything else? Are they looking to hire more teachers that have these skills, or are they already there?
Yeah, so you have to be certified to teach bilingual classes, but what it seems like is happening around here, and I'm sure in other parts of the state, is that people have the certification, but they don't have jobs. So I think what we'll see is a lot of people sort of coming out of the woodwork and saying, oh, I have this, I'd like to use it if there's a chance for me to use it. And also Fresno State's excited because they're hoping that a lot of their teachers and education majors will go ahead and get that certification to use it, because why not, right?
You mentioned that Fresno Unified is ahead of the curve. Are other districts trying to get up to speed on this?
I think it was sort of a political thing, you know. You couldn't do it really without any sort of demand, and then how do you have demand if nobody knows about it? It was an awareness issue, so I think it's hard to know what parts of the state wanted it and what we'll see now, but I think definitely that it's sort of out there in the open and the research is pretty clear and seems like it can't be debated any longer. I think they'll pop up everywhere.
As we look at the aftermath of the election, both the Proposition 58, there's also two new school board members who are going to be seated soon. That could mean changes in the future. The board recently voted to approve a positive evaluation for Superintendent Michael Hansen. That was an interesting vote, though, 4-2, and one board member was absent. Tell us about how that went down, and we'll get into the potential future there as well. But what exactly happened last week?
Yeah, so school board president Luis Chavez, that was his last meeting, was the evaluation vote. He was just elected to Fresno City Council, but he showed up late. So, and the evaluation is a vote that's maybe more people are looking at this year. It's an annual thing, but this year, you know, the school district's under federal investigation. Superintendent Hansen has gotten a lot of heat in the past year, so people want to know how his employees, which are the board members, would evaluate him. And Chavez showed up late, so he was marked absent. So it was a 4-2 vote, 2 negative, 4 positive. But I caught Chavez before I left, and he says, you know, I was just late. I didn't do it on purpose to show up late here.
Is that unusual for the board president to show up late to a meeting, especially one of significance like that?
I would say yes, but, you know, he might have some new duties. Maybe he's running all around town. He did say he was coming from a meeting. So, and he did tell me how he would have voted, and he said he would have voted no. So I'm not going to speculate, but he said he wasn't pulling anything quick on us and that he just showed up late, but that he would have been a no, which is interesting because, you know, then we're 4-3. And when you have almost half of a school board saying that they don't believe in their superintendent, you know, that's kind of alarming.
Yeah. And past evaluations had also been on a 5-2 vote. As I understand it, the two that voted against, Kara Mills and Brooke Ashton, have been consistent critics of the superintendent. What do we know about the two incoming board members, and have they tipped their hands at all in how they view the superintendent?
Yeah, so Elizabeth Jonathan Rosas and Claudia Cazares, I've asked them both. They're the new school board members. And of course, I had to ask them how they feel about the superintendent. And they both sort of said, you know, we're not against saying that he needs to move on, but also we're not going to be hired one day and then kick him out of the district the next. So in a nutshell, they both said, we'll give him a chance, but we're coming in knowing all of these things that we've read in the paper and heard about. And you know, one of them said, we're going to remind him that he works for us and not the other way around. So there is a chance that there could be a new majority that by next year, when they go to vote for his evaluation, it could be overwhelmingly negative instead of positive.
Now, there's also another allegation that's out there against one of the board members, Brooke Ashton, about his involvement with the district and his business interests there. He says this is a political retaliation by an outside group that presumably is more favorable to Superintendent Hansen. What's going on there? What's the status of that? Is there anything really happening there?
It's complicated. It might be hard to try to wrap up, but there is an ongoing investigation now into Brooke from the FPPC, and we'll see if, you know, there's anything that comes out of that. We don't know. They've just agreed to sort of take up complaints that have to do with his business. He owns a paving business, and whether he, is indirectly has a conflict of interest with some of the businesses that the school district also does business with, and whether or not his duty on the board is somehow wrongly overlapped with his work as a businessman in Fresno. But he definitely has been very vocal against the superintendent. And so as soon an attorney kind of came up and wouldn't say who he was working for and made these allegations, Brooke was quick to say, you know, come on, I'm being punished for speaking out. So, you know, I've asked that attorney who's sort of going after him who he works for, and he won't say.
Very interesting. And you also had another article last week, speaking of Superintendent Hansen, his pay, $370,000 in total pay and benefits, an eye-popping number, perhaps. Can you put that in context?
Yeah, the average superintendent in California makes about $200,000. And it depends on what year you're looking at, but he's definitely one of the highest paid. But then again, he's in charge of the fourth largest school district in California. But it is, I think, a hard pill to swallow, especially for teachers who compare that to their compensation packages, and especially because of the past few years that we've had.
And again, that's something that is always controversial. Wouldn't the district also have to pay a lot for any other superintendent they would bring in?
Yes, but I don't know it would compare. Yeah,
Mackenzie Mays with the Fresno Bee joining us today to talk about the issues regarding the Fresno Unified School District. We'll continue to follow those in the Bee and online as well. Mackenzie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. This week, we aired another story in our ongoing series, Just One Breath. It's about Valley Fever in Central California. Earlier in our program today, we introduced you to sixth grader Faith Herrett, who struggles to find energy for school and her pet dogs because of her ongoing recovery from the disease. Of course, the fungal disease can afflict individuals of any age and ethnic group, even those who have lived and worked in the Valley for decades. As part of our first-person series, My Valley, My Story, FM 89's Carrie Klein brings us to the annual Valley Fever Walk in Bakersfield, where a Kern County man who overcame Valley Fever shares his story with us.
My name is James Taplin. I was diagnosed in 2010, and like many others, I thought I had pneumonia. But I went to my primary physician, who thought I was having a heart attack, and I ended up in Bakersfield Heart Hospital, where they diagnosed me pretty much immediately. And I'm of the firm belief that it saved my life. I was in the hospital nearly a month, and it took me a year to heal. Maybe not completely, but almost get there. I actually initially got worse. I mean, I went through the whole thing. I bottomed out and resuscitation and all those things that people don't like to talk about. But when I got out of the hospital, I could not literally open a bottle of water. I just had no strength. You know, I feel like it was a blessing that I was able to come back. I'm an environmental engineer, so I work a lot in the oil fields. And they told me that I had it, and I thought, I've been here all my life. I knew what it was. I couldn't have even told you it was a fungus disease. I just, you know, other people got it. And, you know, that's just what I knew. But I think it was part of work and working in the fields and the dust. You know, that's why I try to share what I went through. Most people don't go through what I went through, but I probably would have tried to find something else to do because, you know, I'm fortunate to be here, but the trade-off could have been not worth it.
You can find more stories in our first-person series, My Valley, My Story, on the web at kvpr.org, as well as more stories in our series about Valley Fever, Just One Breath. That's kvpr.org. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Next Thursday, Fresno art lovers will be out on the town enjoying the city's monthly Art Hop event. But this month, the first Thursday also has an added component at Arte Americas. Event organizers are calling Book Hop. It's a chance to meet local authors and purchase some of their newest works. Two of the authors featured join us now, David Moss Masumoto and his daughter Nikiko. In our studio, they have their new book, Changing Seasons, A Father, A Daughter, A Family Farm. Moss also has another book titled A Sense of Yosemite, which is a collaboration with photographer Nancy Robbins. Moss and Nikiko, welcome to Valley Public Radio.
Thanks so much for having us.
Oh, thank you. It's always a pleasure to share some stories with you.
I want to talk about the Yosemite book in a moment, but let's start out with your collaboration, Changing Seasons. Now, that is a name that has we've talked about a lot here on this program, both in the Changing Season film that was on PBS nationally. Now there's a book. And it's some new material. Tell us about how this came about, Moss.
We wanted to make a collection that was sort of a companion book to the PBS broadcast, and it would give more of the backstory of some of the themes and issues that were in that PBS film, which was about Nakiko taking over the family farm and the dynamics of generations and transition. This gives the backstory of some of those themes of my parents and grandparents and their experience on the land, and also the dialogue, the exchange between Nakiko and myself.
Nakiko, what's it like getting to work with your father on a book?
It echoes many of the ways that we work together on the farm. There's lots of laughter. There's lots of respect and exchange. And there's also lots of differences of ideas. One of my favorite sections of the book that I think really captures some of the departures and differences between us across generations and across opinions is there's a couplet of essays, one by me and one by my dad, about feminism and farming. And it's a fun window into my orientation as a woman farmer, as a queer farmer, as a proud feminist farmer, and my dad's kind of interesting negotiation of what that means for him.
It's her nice way of saying that I was dumbfounded when she showed me this essay and I was wanting to respond to it. So, you know, my first line was, you know, am I a feminist farmer? And I kind of go through a process of trying to think through this because it was a question I was never asked before.
So there's a little bit of a dialogue back and forth here. Talk about that.
Yeah, there's a couple different pairs of essays that we write about either the same topic or similar topics. And so we're hoping that when people get to read from our different perspectives, they hear this really generous and serious negotiation across generations. That's all part of, I think, a lot of what families, specifically family businesses, go through as people age and newer generations age too. And how do we talk to each other? How do we communicate with each other? And how do we negotiate some of the differences in generations?
Go ahead, Moss.
And the book is really divided into three sections, sort of the past, present, and the future. And in the past, we do explore the common family history that, of course, Nakiko and I share, and a different perspective that she has on that, of me growing up on a farm, you know, in the 60s and 70s versus her growing up on the farm and much more in this century, but also the present and especially the future of what we're going to look at and the things that are unknown that are part of this story.
Now, we've had both of you on this program and this station before and talked about some of these things, and I think I've often asked Nakiko, what have you learned from your father? Moss, what have you learned from Nakiko in both this book and in overall?
You like that silence that I have right there? it's a learning process. I mean, the whole idea of transitions and generations is something that you think you're prepared for, because obviously I went through it with my father and taking over the farm with my father, but it's always different, and it's this new ability to understand that things are always incomplete. And in looking at that perspective and understanding that as Nakiko learns some things, it learns things differently than I did and also has a completely different perspective, sometimes I realize the best thing I could do is have a moment of silence and think things through as I realize I don't need to respond, because in an amazing way, this is all new to me and I think, of course, new to her.
Is it also in some ways a matter of just that there's not necessarily a right way or a wrong way? There's just different ways?
Well, at first I thought the right way was my way, of course. Yeah. And then the next realization was, well, no, there isn't a right way or wrong way. It's just different. But you know, Joe, as you get older, sometimes you don't want change and difference. You want things to stay the same, but that's not quite how it works.
Again, David Masumoto and his daughter Nakiko Masumoto joining us today on our program. They have a new book called Changing Seasons, A Father, A Daughter, A Family Farm. Moss also has another book, which we'll talk about in a moment. It's called A Sense of Yosemite, which is a collaboration with photographer Nancy Robbins. Nagiko, what have you learned in the process of now doing this book, especially in the context that this is after the film? You already kind of know what came out of that process and going through that experience of having the documentarians and everything that happened during that time. What have you learned during that process?
I think a couple things, specifically with the book and the way that we have continued to engage in conversations that you see in the film. One of my conclusions is that we can never listen enough. Listening is an ongoing process, and real listening requires being attuned to your own assumptions, and that's really hard work. It's really, really hard work. And I think one of the gifts from the film for me was realizing that there was a hunger from the public to hear these kind of behind the scenes processes, like these really intimate moments of how we consider each other, how we physically farm together, how we walk through the halls of the house that I now live in with my partner that my dad grew up in, and how we negotiate as that house physically transforms and changes, and we have a changing sense of home. And how can we, across generations, not make the elder generations feel obsolete, but rather have their work and their story be part of the root of the change that is happening now. And that work is never done. And it takes a lot of patience and it takes a lot of renewal of energy. You can't just listen once and say, okay, we're done. We have this, 50-page plan of how we're going to transition the farm. No, it's an ongoing process as we change, as we grow, and we all age together.
Moss, when you make a film, when you write a book, there's at some point the final manuscript is sent in. It's done. It's finished. The final edit of the film is done. It's out there. But what you're writing about here is really about transition and a process. And not necessarily just walking away and saying, hey, Nagiko, it's yours. See you later. Is that the interesting part of this? Because it's not just a finite conclusion, because things are always changing and there is no end point here?
When you work on a film or a book, there is obviously a point where you have to stop and let go, because they need to go to the film needs to be broadcast and the book needs to be printed. The challenge is, of course, life continues. And in that, there's this whole sense that life is always incomplete. And it's hard. There's times when you want closure on things. And you go, no, life is always about continuing this journey. And it's part of the biggest challenge for me. Because as I age, there are times when you would like to put closure on something. Now, there's this natural rhythm in farming where every season you have the end of the season like we have right now where, we get some good rains. There's the first chill in the air. You know, the leaves are falling on the trees, off the trees. So there's a sense there is the end of one year. And you take a deep breath and then you look and realize there's another year and another year. That's the beauty and joy of life. But it's also the challenge, too, because it's never ending.
Your thoughts on that, Nagiko?
Yeah, Joe, I think you picked up on something really nuanced and really at the heart of what we live out on our farm, working intergenerationally, that we have a tendency to want to iron out narratives of story. We want the really easy beginning, middle, and end, and a kind of bow on the conclusion, right? And I'm guilty of this myself, coming back to farm, thinking that being a next generation of farming meant that the transition was all about me. And that's not true at all. And that the moment is not a single moment, but it's decades of transition. And we have to tend to ourselves and tend to that unfolding story, even though it's sometimes frustrating or sometimes tantalizing in wanting to wrap things in that nice, beautiful bow. And so that I think exactly what you picked up, this incompleteness, this unfolding over time, is what makes both the film and the book so important for us to document, to take a pause and reflect on in a process that is full of emotion and uncertainty in for both the good and the bad.
The book is called Changing Seasons, A Father, A Daughter, A Family Farm. It's by David Mas Masumoto and his daughter Nikiko Masumoto. They join us today on Valley Public Radio. They'll be signing this book, which is available for sale next Thursday night, December 1st, at Arte Americas for Art Hop. There's also another book, though, Mas, which I want to bring to the table here and tell our listeners about, and it is a little different. This one is about Yosemite, and you're collaborating with a photographer. How challenging is it to find something new to say about something that is so universally known, so ubiquitous as Yosemite?
It was an interesting, I don't know if a challenge, an interesting endeavor, because I saw the photographs of Nancy, and they're stunning photographs, and she, again, wanted to take pictures of Yosemite from her perspective. She lives in the area. She's not a visiting photographer. She knows it well. She knows the backcountry well. So they initially asked me to write about Yosemite, and I thought about it, and I realized I wanted to write from my perspective, which was a perspective of a farmer looking at Yosemite. And one of the passages I talk about, our farm lives in the shadow of Yosemite. We're 90 miles south of the southern gate to it. And in the book, I try to weave in a farmer's perspective of the sense of place and how that parallels a sense of place about Yosemite. There's a chapter in there, and Nancy took this amazing photograph. If you remember the Rim Fire that was about 2 or 3 years ago that devastated that whole area, you could see the smoke from our farm, and most of us in the valley at one point were breathing in that smoke too. So it was the realization of the question, is Yosemite our Yosemite, or is it something distant? And that fire in many ways made us realize we're all part of this whole region. We're sharing, literally sharing the air of Yosemite with all of us. And it gave me a different sense of looking at how do I relate to this amazing national park as a farmer. And that's how the stories began.
Your first essay in the book looks at Yosemite through the eyes of a farmer. And you write that growing up, you went to Yosemite, but not often enough. Mm. Tell me about those early experiences and what you mean there by saying that.
One of the ironies is most people go to Yosemite during the summer, and it's when it's gorgeous, you know, the waterfalls are going. That's on a farm, our busiest time. So we never went during the summer. We were always going in the off season. And we, even though it was that close, we didn't go as often. And I think it's very true with most people in the valley. We don't understand and engage with this national treasure as much. But yet, I think we have developed a relationship with it. And there was this old picture that I found from, you know, 1959, when I was like 5 years old, and we were crossing this old wooden bridge in part of Yosemite over the river there. I thought about that moment in time and what it meant to be part of something amazing and grand that endures. And the things in Yosemite are the same. I mean, you still have Half Dome and you have Yosemite Valley. They're the same, and yet they're different because time has passed and I have changed too. So I would look at that photograph of that bridge, and there's a whole symbolism of crossing the bridge with my family and my father, who was this hardworking farmer who rarely would vacation in Yosemite, but yet understanding that wonder of nature and a nature that he worked with daily on the farm at the same time.
Yeah, and those legacies of those photos that come back to us when we see these places again. You also take the idea of sense of Yosemite in another way, the other senses that we have, sight, sound, touch, taste. Tell me about that.
Well, one of the thoughts is we tend to visit places through our eyes and what we see. But one of the questions I pose is, what does Yosemite smell like? And there are aromas in Yosemite we may relate with the smell of pine. But there are other aromas in Yosemite that are part of it. And some of it is like the aroma in Yosemite Valley, if you're in there in the evening and you smell campfires. And you know that this is not just a place that's exiled from humans. Humans are part of this. We're part of Yosemite. So you breathe in that campfire, and it automatically connects you with maybe campfires you've had and experienced in your life, whether it be in Yosemite or not. That's that wonderful dynamic of the power of story and memory and the senses, because you can't just separate them. They all come together. So when I breathe in a scent of a campfire, no matter where I am, I will think of Yosemite at the same time. But there are other things. What's the sound of Yosemite? What's the feel of Yosemite? And all of those senses we have experienced. We just may not be that aware of it. So through Nancy's photographs and some of my words, hopefully the reader will be able to enjoy all those different sensations of Yosemite.
Nikiko, given what Moss is just talking about, especially with the photos and the shared memory of this place, which all of us have some connection to and a similar story in some way to what Moss just talked about, a common thread between what you're talking about in Changing Seasons and what Moss is talking about in this book as well?
I think so. When I hear my dad talk about relating to Yosemite as a farmer, I think there's a question there about public sense of belonging. And I think that that's a question that we are grappling with, working with between us on the farm, of like a shared sense of belonging across generations on the farm. And it's definitely something that we take up in our work feeding people. How do we cultivate the earth and at the same time invest in relationships that foster a shared sense of public belonging? Because I think that is a key if we're thinking about environmental sustainability, economic sustainability, and the circulation of stories that give us meaning. I think we really need to pay attention to that shared sense of belonging.
And one of the dynamics too, Joe, is that when you think of Yosemite as a public space, a national park, for the public, for the common good, we grow fruit that's not private. All of our peaches and nectarines and the organic raisins, they go into the public. So in a way, where our farm is public too. And what's that relationship? Because it's not just a commodity. We do like to think of it as if we're selling a relationship with each peach and a story with each peach, which makes our farming very different the way we approach it.
David Moss Masumoto and Nikiko Masumoto will be at Book Hop. It's coming up next Thursday, December 1st, at Arte Americas in downtown Fresno. They'll be there with a number of other authors displaying their latest books, signing, not a formal reading or anything, but a great opportunity to connect with some of the Valley's finest authors. The two books, again, we just talked about A Sense of Yosemite, which is a collaboration between Moss and photographer Nancy Robbins, and also Changing Seasons, A Father, A Daughter, A Family Farm by David Moss Masumoto and Nikiko Masumoto. Thanks so much for both of you joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you,
Joe.
And that's all for today's Valley Edition. Join us next week. We'll hear from more authors, including Armin Bacon and Doug Hansen. That's coming up next week on our program. As always, we'd like to know what you think. Email us talk@kvpr.org or send us a tweet. We are @KVPR and @Valley Edition. You can find our podcast, audio archives, and more on our website as well at kvpr.org. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Kerry Klein and Jeffrey Hess, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.